So to answer your first question about unions and them playing a gatekeeper role, I can't speak on behalf of the entire activist community. That would be homogenizing all of them. But I can definitely tell you from my point of view and a few others, I think unions as well as agencies very much do play a gatekeeping role because, you know, they work 9 to 5, they get paid for their job. Are they really activists? There's a lot of dialogue to have there, but I think what's important is to acknowledge the work that unions can do within activist spaces, right? So unions have been very supportive in our cause. There are people who are part of unions who are active activists within No One Is Illegal, right? So we meet every single Wednesday in Toronto for 2 hours to talk about all of this stuff and, you know, future actions and further our analysis. And a lot of the people who come out to our weekly meetings are people who happen to also be part of unions. So why that's helpful is they leave our meetings with this analysis and then they get to tap into unions to help us with funding. They've been very financially supportive. As a grassroots organization, we have little to no funding, especially because we can't and won't take funding from the government, from CIC, and, you know, from businesses, etc. And also, I think unions have been really supportive in our movements in helping us with getting high numbers. A big part of a demonstration or a protest or a rally is the number of bodies you have there, which said the more bodies you have, the stronger the statement you make and the clearer your message that this will not be tolerated by the people, by our community, by the public, right? They've been helpful in that regard. I think their analysis, because people who are part of unions are part of the working class, right? And the vast majority of non-status migrants come from working class communities. So I think there's a lot of links there, and I think they're helpful links, despite the fact that they may have barriers that activist communities don't have.
Yeah, and just to add on, with respect to the union and migrant farm workers, there has been a lot of work over the past few years, especially to try and organize migrant farm workers as well as other farm workers. But in Ontario, it has been illegal for any farm worker to collectively bargain, which has pretty much rendered unionization ineffective. So in other provinces where unionization of farm workers is legal, they've been starting to unionize workforces very slowly, but they faced a lot of opposition. And here in Ontario, they're challenging that exclusion. So if that changes, union representation could really fundamentally change some of the dynamics of power. And I think the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in particular has been really active in supporting migrant farm workers. And I think that the unions play a very important role in continuing to do so with solidarity with migrant workers.
And you need that space, yep. Right? You need migrants to be able to go to unions because unions fight for worker rights. And if non-status people are included from that, you're excluding a big number of people who need rights, right? It makes sense. Have we answered your questions? Yeah?
You had a few, but maybe we can chat after. But the C50?
I think maybe because that's such a general question and there's a lot to be discussed, we can talk about that maybe afterwards. Yeah?
First of all, I'd like to thank you all for coming here. I really had no idea that a lot of this stuff was happening in my own country. If we, as Canadians, or to implement a more fair immigration policy, what would be the first or the most vital step to take to do so?
It's really difficult to categorize just in because there's so many things that need to be reformed. And personally, I think a reform isn't enough because I think the immigration system is so systematically problematic in terms of how classist it is and how racist it is, that we really need to deconstruct it and start from scratch. But that's a perfect world. Let's talk about our unperfect world. I think one thing that's really important is needing a repeal system. So you may or may not know, more than 60% of refugee claimants are denied their claim, right? So basically, the system is failing more than half of the people who are trying to use it. Do you know what a PRA is? A pre-removal risk assessment? Okay, so basically when you apply for refugee status, if you are denied, that you are given a deportation notice, right? Should you choose not to leave because there are cases, like currently we are working with somebody who her husband has sent her death threats. In the last 10 years, he has hospitalized her 3 times because he has beat her so severely, and she has come to Canada with her 2 children, and she applied for refugee status, but her claim was denied. So she was given a deportation order, but she chose not to leave because she genuinely is afraid that her husband will kill her. And he sent her notes, which she has with her, that say, if you return, I will kill you and I will kill both of our children. And even then, she did not qualify under our system for protection from our state, right? She was told rather that she should go back and the Mexican state should deal with its own human rights abuses, even though, you know, Amnesty International has said time and time again that there is an issue of, you know, the Mexican government dealing with violence against women, right? But because we have NAFTA and Canada and Mexico sort of share this cozy relationship, it looks bad for us to say, well, your government isn't dealing with things properly with the refugees there, and therefore will step in and help, because that affects that political system, right? And that itself requires a whole separate analysis. But I think what's necessary is a repeal system. So we have the PRA, which is the pre-removal risk assessment. So when a refugee, like the case I just told you about, Isabel Garcia, when she was denied her claim, she got a PRA done, for which you have to pay lawyers thousands of dollars, but even then she got it done. And what that is, it's pre-removal, meaning right before you're about to be deported, they do a risk assessment. So, okay, let's look at your case one last time and see, really, do you maybe qualify as a refugee under Canada? And out of the millions of people who go through their PRA, less than 1% are granted stay, right? So, and there's no repeal process, right? So if the judge says, no, you can't go, there's nowhere for you to take that. There, you can't get another lawyer to fight it. You can't go to the Supreme Court. You are removed and you're deported. So I think that's definitely one change that needs to happen.
I will also refrain from broad utopian visions, which will never come to pass in my lifetime, of borderless worlds, which would be the ideal. In terms of just dealing with the issue of temporary foreign workers, I really believe that anyone who comes here to work is good enough to stay. And so I think that there should be a path to permanent residency for anyone who has worked here. And I also believe that people who have been here working undocumented should also have a path to permanent residency. And so that would be the first thing, is to open up paths for those people. Fundamentally, the Canadian immigration system needs to recognize that people of all skill levels are needed in Canada, not just the doctors who come here and then can't be doctors anyway, but people of all backgrounds and skill levels. And a recognition of that at a fundamental level would mean equal rights for all migrants, not just those with higher skill levels, to be able to reside here as future citizens.
I second those changes.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Hello. I've got 2 comments and then a question. In the first one is that I really liked your exposition about the working around the world of being illegal, no? Because being illegal of what? Of breathing, of eating, or walking? Like, how can someone be illegal? It's just the very terminology is out of the way. And then also that idea of if someone works, someone gets paid and someone gets the benefits. There's nothing of charity or anything like there. Like it's that's the deal. You work, you get the benefits. So it doesn't matter if you have status, if you don't. Like that's usually how things work. No, the other thing is that it amazes me how most of these things are happening in sort of like a democratic context. No, like for example, I'm from Spain. And in Spain, we treat migrants not like second-class citizens, but like something much worse. For example, not very far away, like a couple of months ago, a boat full of immigrants, a boat full of migrants coming from the north of Africa, it was a boat full of 150 people, sank into the Mediterranean in front of the Italian coasts, and no one did anything. Because Italy didn't want those people to come to. This boat was actually coming from Greece, and Greece didn't want them. So it's really amazing how things are starting to look like in a democratic context. So for example, the detention centers that you were talking about right now, the European Union has passed a law that is the law of return. It has been already called the law of the shame, because it allows European countries to hold migrants for at least 18 months in detention centers. In those detention centers, migrants, I mean, people give birth, people suicide, people the health conditions are not, basically, and that's happening in front of our eyes. So my last question and my last question for you all is, who is being benefited of all this, of this machine that is getting so big and so huge? Because, surprise, surprise, a couple of months ago also, for example, I'm talking about what I know, but the European Union passed a law in which it allows a contract of 65 hours per week. So not anymore the 35 hours per week, 8 hours sleeping, 8 hours working, 8 hours of pleasure. No, 65 hours per week. And this happens in a context where there's a lot of migrant illegal population in Europe. So what's happening this is all happening at the same time. It's a rights, worker rights are being taken away in a context that it doesn't really affect the big companies, because in a sense big companies are it's not that they don't want migrants, it's that they want them illegal. So my question is, who is this benefiting, all this? It is who's getting a benefit of the mess of taking rights in one part from the population that has them and avoiding the population that should have them, because they're working, therefore they should get the benefits, mm-hmm. to not have them anymore.
Okay, well, there's two main groups that benefit, the employers and the state. The employers benefit because they have a cheap, flexible workforce who they can hire and fire and pay less than Canadian citizens at their discretion. And the minute one gets sick, they can be disposed of rather than having any responsibility over. But the Canadian state also benefits too. These workers pay into employment insurance, taxes, pension, etc. Often they don't gain any benefits from that. So there's a huge surplus that the Canadian government is earning on the backs of these workers that pay into these benefits. The Canadian state also benefits because they do not have to support these migrants when they become sick. They do not have to support these migrants' children getting educated. All of that is exported back to the global south. So really, you're getting citizens of other countries in their most productive years able to work the hardest jobs to keep the economy going and to allow for cheap production of products for the rest of us to consume. And then the minute something goes wrong, the state doesn't have to take care of them. They just ship them home. So these migrant worker programs and the use of undocumented peoples is very beneficial to the state. It's very beneficial to employers. And that's the reason, one of the reasons, why they've continued to have these policies that make no sense from any kind of human rights or justice perspective. They make no sense, and they contradict the public persona of a multicultural, human rights loving nation, but they keep doing it because it's economically feasible and Canadians don't raise any issues about it. Look at the last campaign for the election. Immigration wasn't on anyone's radar. We talked about arts funding ad nauseum, but no one talked about immigration. No one talked about these issues. And so if Canadians aren't raising it, politicians don't feel the need to address it. And that's the underlying truth.
And that's where you all come in.
That's where you come in, that's yeah. Right.
Also, I wanted to just add, I mean, we are bringing in more and more immigrants and refugees on temporary work visas, so it's not like we don't need the immigrants. We just don't want to allow them to access certain channels which will allow them a path to become permanent residents. We need them, but only to work, not to stay, right?
Yeah, we need them, but we need them illegal, vulnerable, with
exactly.
No rights.
And they pay taxes, right? They pay GST, PST, property tax, gas tax. Many of them pay employment insurance, but they can't access any of this, right? And I also want to mention, that's why writing letters to politicians, emailing them, faxing them, it works. I know it sounds tedious and it, you know, what difference is it going to make? But like, that's how we win a lot of our casework, right? Like I mentioned, there's a student at UFT, at York University, who was going to be deported. All we did, Diane Finley, she was the immigration minister. I got every single one of my friends to make a phone call to Diane Finley's office and just leave a message saying, hi, I'm a student from the University of whatever, and I was really concerned because I heard so-and-so was being deported, and I think under Canadian Immigration Act, we should allow her to continue to stay because she's not finished university yet. Just a simple message. It's not even that politicized. There's little analysis in it, but they got 60 of those calls in one day, and then suddenly the minister was like, okay, hold on, people know that this is happening and they care, so how can I look like the good guy? Oh, I know, I'll overturn the deportation, right?
Exactly.
And that's how you get things on politicians' platforms, right? Just mobilizing, having demos, writing letters.
And No One Is Illegal has a website with a listserv that you can join in on these campaigns. Justice for Migrant Workers has a listserv as well. If you can Google either of these groups, they'll come up. And you can join these listservs and get involved in these campaigns. And right here on campus, there's the Student Support for Migrant Workers, OPIRG, the CSA, who are all seeming to mobilize. So there are really good opportunities for people to get involved. And you can change the system if we come together as a critical mass. That's the only way to do it.
I don't know if I'm allowed a last question, because someone was talking about this of showing solidarity and how can we change the minds. And but it is also amazing how the message on the media is always the migrants coming and trying to rob the resources in here, and how very rarely the message is on the opposite. What are our countries are robbing in the countries of origin? How many resources, how much privatization is going on because of Western countries? And so maybe changing that where the arrow is going, thank you very much.
Thank you, those were great comments.
Hi, sorry. I just wanted to quickly say that I'm part of a group that was mentioned just now, Student Support for Migrant Workers. So we're on campus and we've been doing different initiatives surrounding some of these issues, and we would like to sort of branch out to other issues as well, just on the broader theme of immigration and migrant rights. If anybody's interested as well, we have some information over there as well. My comment also was that I really like the fact that we sort of are talking about sort of this need for us as Canadians to sort of pursue these things, and we have this, you know, obligation almost living in this democratic country that we're saying, because a lot of the times, like, not to sort of take responsibility away from the liaison officers. For example, in the SOP program, the embassies of Jamaica and of Mexico are supposed to be the representatives, are supposed to be the resources for these workers. And not to take, you know, responsibility away from them, but these countries are also, you know, working in the broader sort of global environment. And, you know, remittances for them are huge, right? Like, the jobs, like we said, in the broader sort of like neoliberal context, through NAFTA, through free trade, a lot of these individuals can't get jobs in their home countries. That's why they're immigrating. So remittances are huge in their economies. So for them, it sort of puts them in a tough spot to claim rights, to sort of empower their workers, because they see as Canada that it's very easy for Canada sort of to say, you know what, Jamaica is asking for us to sort of, is asking for more rights, is asking for, you know, empowerment. And you know, Jamaica would get worried that Canada can then just shift and go to the next sort of cheaper labor country that's not going to ask for those rights. So I think that's really important that as Canadians we pursue this, because in the global context, you know, a lot of other countries, you know, through their benefit economic gains, they're not in the best sort of situation. Also to voice that concern. If you guys want to respond to that as well, and also the sheet that we have signed up for OPIRG, it says OPIRG Working Group. That's the sheet that we're trying to sort of establish something here and based on the university. So it's just right over there if anybody is interested in joining up. Thank you.
Thank you. I think you're absolutely right, and I agree with your assessment.
So. Me too.
A+.
Yeah, I was just wondering if this pool of like non-status labor is really key to the economy, then why at the same time do they make it so hard to even get like temporary visas? Like, do you think they actually want people to come like in illegal ways?
Yes.
And so then, but then why are at the same time the borders like like the U.S. border is like insanely monitored, like yeah. So in a way they don't want those workers to come illegally.
Do you want to speak?
Well, yeah, I think we'll both have something to say on this. I think the U.S. is a really good example. The United States relies on millions of undocumented workers for their economy to function, for their food to get picked. And they need these undocumented immigrants. And I believe that the construction of the wall along the border and the security, it's all just political because there are racist Americans who are demanding of their politicians to have more security against the... And this has really increased in the post 9/11 era. And politicians, in order to gain support, have to show that they're tough on security, that they're not going to let the terrorists invade the homeland.
To get votes.
And to get votes. So the wall is basically just buying votes. It's buying votes from Americans who are afraid of immigrants. And it has no other function in terms of the utilitarian capacity. This wall has created so many problems for migrating animals across the desert, and all it's done is pushed migrants into a much smaller corridor to cross. It hasn't actually stopped illegal migration, and through doing this, many more migrants are now dying trying to cross the border. So you can see what's happening in Canada just on a slightly smaller scale, but it's similar rationale. The Canadian authorities seem to need to prove that they're enforcing things. But the truth is, going after these school children isn't going to protect us from terrorism. So it's really just, in my opinion, a political ploy, and not really actually because they want these immigrants to leave the country. We need them here to do the crappy work.
Have you heard of Minutemen? Okay, so there's a documentary, Crossing Our Zone. I definitely recommend it to everybody to watch. So it's about the increased, the heightened security at the U.S.-Mexico border. So a record 4,000 Mexicans a day are trying to cross that border, and yearly hundreds, or I don't know if at this point it's thousands, are dying. Many are dying out of thirst or hunger. Many are getting lost in the desert and dying. Many are just downright beaten or shot or stabbed to death at the border by immigration officers, right? So there's
Minutemen.
Or by Minutemen. So Minutemen is this group of extremely conservative, crazy racist white men, basically, some of their wives have joined the movement too, and they're just these really suburban white families who live near the border who think that immigrants are a threat and that America was perfect and because it was founded by white people, even though it wasn't because it was founded by indigenous people, but they think that because America was founded by white people and established by white people should get to dictate all policies and people of color do nothing but, you know, spoil the environment, and that is all of the problems in the States can be blamed on people of color trying to cross the border. That's their analysis, and they have actually lobbied hundreds of supporters, and they've made the statement that the American government is not taking immigration seriously, so they consider themselves activists. So what they do is they arm themselves with guns and knives, they stand in hundreds at near or at the U.S.-Mexico border, and they themselves take justice into their own hands, and they sort of arrest, report, detain, or beat up people who are trying to cross the border, right? And that sends activists send a clear message to politicians, whether they're on the right side or the wrong side. And that message sends to politicians, the message sent there is that people don't want immigrants in America, and look how hard they're mobilizing to stop them. If I take it up on my platform to increase national security and immigration security and whatnot, then I'm going to get more votes. So I think that's a part of it. And I also think, have you heard of A Day Without an Immigrant? Has anybody heard about that?
Is it A Day Without a Mexican?
That could be something else.
Oh, okay. There's also a film called A Day Without a Mexican.
A Day Without an Immigrant is a day in the United States where all non-status migrants across the United States in almost every state marched in solidarity. And for one day, every non-status person, and there were thousands of them, who decided not to go to work for that one day. And the economy lost millions of dollars, right? So that sort of sent the statement that, well, what do you mean migrants don't contribute? Like in one day, because some of the non-status or the illegal immigrants didn't work, you lost millions of dollars. That's a contribution, right?
And A Day Without a Mexican is a film parroting this reality. It's basically showing a whole day with all of a sudden all of the Mexicans disappear from the United States. So mothers can't feed their children because they don't know how to cook, and no one is there to drive the guy to work, and it just, everything falls apart.
The restaurants
basically
are empty, no the one restaurants knows how to get their own food. Like,
yeah, yes. It just shows what would happen, because there are something like 13 million estimated Latino immigrants undocumented in the United States. So imagine if all of those people are doing all of these jobs that, You know, these are the base of the economy. Everything else builds up from those jobs. So if the base is pulled out, everything collapses. So watch that film if you want to chuckle.
I'm not sure if you have mentioned this before. I got here a bit late, but I'm just wondering your perspective on the government's actions towards current war resistors here in Canada, and if no one is illegal has mobilized around their issue.
So no one is illegal is definitely strongly in support of war resistors being able to claim status in Canada. Are people familiar with the issue of war resistor refugees? So people who are resisting the war in Iraq, soldiers who don't want to go to Iraq, are coming to Canada and claiming refugee status. And Canada has decided not to allow them to make that claim on the grounds that, do you guys know what the Safe Third Party Agreement, Safe Third Country Agreement is? So it's this act, basically it's an agreement between Canada and America that when an immigrant or refugee, the first safe country deemed safe by the people in this agreement, and so basically Canada and America, the first safe country that an immigrant or refugee lands in, they have to make their status claim in that country. So for example, even if an immigrant is coming to Canada but they have a stopover flight in, say, England or America, once they get to Canada, they are not allowed to make claim for status because they already landed in a safe country. Why didn't they apply for status there, right? And this goes back to what I was saying about Canada enjoying cozy relationships with certain countries. So it's difficult for Canada to say, you know, we're going to accept war resistors here in Canada as refugees, because that sends America the system that we don't think it's right that you have this war in Iraq, or we, you know, we want to protect your American soldiers who aren't getting protection in America. And Canada doesn't feel it's in the position to tell America that it is not, you know, a safe country, or to tell America that it should be accepting these refugees, right? And as part of that cozy relationship, Canada sends them back because that instead sends the message that if you're not good enough to stay in America, then you're not good enough to stay in Canada. It's this sort of skewed solidarity between the countries, right? And also, like, war resist, like, Canada has not officially supported the war in Iraq, but informally, they have supported it in so many ways. For starters, and they didn't support it because there was so much mass mobilization against it, but Canada sent more in 2004, 5, 6, and 7, have steadily been sending more and more soldiers to Afghanistan so that American US soldiers could be free up to go to Iraq, right? If that's not support, I'm not sure what is. Canada's Navy has helped the US Navy, like, not only through people power, but through logistically helping their Navy to reach platforms in which they're able to bomb Iraq more strategically, right? Our Air Force has helped their Air Force logistically. We've had our Canadian military personnel be sent over to America to join this movement, this war in Iraq. I'd hardly call it a movement. So I think, you know, by supporting this war informally, I think it's difficult to say we're going to accept war resistors. And I think that's a big part of what the problem is. But I think No One Is Illegal definitely supports war resistors. We have mobilized, we have taken up more than one case of people who have tried to make claims because of that, but both were unsuccessful claims, unfortunately.